This is Only a Game. I'm Jason Gay. You know, nobody's sure who invented the curveball. Many men have staked a claim. Fred Goldsmith, James Creighton, Phony Martin, Alva Holly, Regis Philbin. All right, I'm just kidding about Regis. But the best claim on the curveball might have come from a guy named Candy Cummings, real name Candy Cummings, who made his major league debut on April 22, 1876 with the famous Hartford Dark Blues. One thing's undeniably true. Since the first curveball was thrown in a major league game, the term has taken on a metaphorical meaning. Today, a curveball also means those moments when life takes on an unexpected direction. Our first curveball today is a story involving football, depression, and comedy, which are three subjects that go together surprisingly well. Here's Only a Game's Martin Kessler.
Could you just introduce yourself? Tell me your name and what you do.
Okay, I am Gary Gulman, and I am a stand-up comedian, almost exclusively.
And how long have you been doing that?
I've been standing up and telling jokes since October 8th, 1993.
Gary Gulman has performed on Jay Leno, David Letterman, Jimmy Kimmel, Conan.
My parents had a very different experience with the phone. This is good. They used to talk to people on it. And to me, the phone is this seldom used app on my phone.
But it's only in the past few years that Gary's really started telling jokes about living with depression. Here he is in January 2017 on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert.
More often than not, I use a fork to eat ice cream. And if you eat ice cream with a fork, I know you so well. I know you so well. Because my policy is I'm not washing a spoon until I'm all out of forks. And people say, why don't you just wash a spoon? Why don't I shower?
And here's the thing. Gary Gulman might not be doing this, might not be talking about his depression, might not even be a stand-up comedian, if it weren't for sports. Gary's story begins in a working-class city outside Boston called Peabody. His parents divorced when he was a toddler. He lived with his mom and two older brothers. He told me they were on food stamps.
And I got free lunch, which was humiliating. They would take the money from all the kids who had money for lunch. And then it was like, all right, now the free lunch kids, why don't you zeros line up and we'll hand you these fluorescent pink tickets. As if the overalls and bare feet didn't give away your level of wealth.
Hockey was one of the first things Gary wished his family could afford, but the $100 fee was too much. So Gary looked for other sports. Some of his friends played football.
And I just remember thinking, that is not for me. I need something where they're penalized for trying to hurt you.
Gary ended up falling in love with basketball, and he quickly stood out. Gary's 6'6", and he could jump higher and run faster than most of the other boys. But there was something they had that he didn't.
They were just tough boys. There was an expression I remember growing up that my father would use to describe, and it was always other people's kids. Oh, he's all boy. That one's all boy. And it was never used to describe me because I was really soft. I had a huge stuffed animals collection. I love to paint and draw, and it's just this ridiculous irony that I was also born with a lot of natural athleticism and size.
Gary's coaches saw a kid who just needed to toughen up. But Gary was the type of kid who stayed up late watching the Johnny Carson show and loved making his teammates laugh by imitating Billy Crystal and SNL. Gary also had this belief that he'd never be happy unless he became a star.
And once you achieved great things, then you would feel good about yourself.
Gary dreamed of someday hosting his own late-night show, but he figured he had a better shot at stardom through basketball. His self-esteem rode on every performance. If he missed his first shot, he'd feel humiliated. After a bad game, he'd feel even worse. Gary still remembers being crushed after one particular eighth-grade scrimmage.
This is very sad. I saw no point to living after that game. I was legitimately contemplating suicide, which is an ill, sick response. It's clear now looking back on that that I had a mental illness.
But it would still be years before Gary Gulman received any help. Gary became a standout high school basketball player. He got attention from some Division III colleges. But during Gary's junior year, a couple of assistant football coaches noticed him dunking in gym class. The coaches were twins in their late 20s. They called themselves the Jetsons. They felt they were out of this world. And they told Gary he could be a bigger star on the football team. Gary tried to ignore them, but the Jetsons were persistent.
The first day of summer vacation, I got a call at 6:30 a.m., and it was one of these guys. He said, "It's Jetson." He gave me the address and directions to this gym and said, "Meet us there in 45 minutes. You're going to train with us all summer, and we're going to get you a scholarship to college." And I hadn't thought about how I was going to pay for college, and they, with one phone call, had put all that anxiety aside because I believed them. They were so convincing.
So Gary spent the summer training to play tight end. When the season began, Gary still didn't really know how to block, so he only played offense in passing situations. The defense knew what was coming, but Gary was so much bigger that he couldn't be stopped. Soon there were newspaper articles calling Gary Mr. Raw Potential.
I remember being very frightened because I was like, I don't feel like this guy who is so dominant and powerful.
But just as the Jetsons had promised, college coaches wanted Gary. He accepted a full athletic scholarship to play at Division I Boston College. The coaches told him he might even get to play as a freshman.
In my head, I was like, this is insane. I don't know how to play football that well. I haven't played very much. And that became clear almost immediately.
Gary fell into a routine. Come home from morning practice, then sleep till afternoon practice.
And it was clear, looking back on it, that I was trying to sleep away my life. I was incredibly depressed.
When the team finally had some time off, Gary went home to Peabody. He mostly slept, but he also talked to his older brother, who'd once suffered from a bout of depression.
He said, "You sound just like me." And I don't know how he had this insight, but he said, "You need to tell somebody at the school how you're feeling."
Gary did. He was sent to Boston College's head of counseling services, a guy named Dr. McGinnis.
He asked me a bunch of questions, and I remember thinking this is really pleasant that somebody is asking me questions about myself and listening. And then maybe halfway through our session, he said, "Why don't you just quit football?" And I remember thinking that was such a crazy idea.
For one, there was his scholarship, and Gary didn't admit it to Dr. McGinnis, but he still felt like he needed to be a star athlete to be a worthy person. So Gary stayed on the team, but he kept seeing Dr. McGinnis.
I think up to that time in my life, I had been depressed most of my life, and I just thought it was how everybody lived, that everybody struggled just to get out of bed every day, and everyone felt that they were a lousy person unless they achieved great things.
Gary never played in a game, but he made it through that freshman season. Sometimes the happiest part of his day was getting his teammates to laugh or listening to comedians on cassette tapes at night. That spring, before the team's big intra-squad scrimmage, Gary met with Dr. McGinnis.
I remember he said this. He said, "I never give advice. I'm giving you advice. You should quit the football team." And I admired this man so much. And I remember before the game, I prayed to God. I said, "Please give me a sign that I should quit the football team."
Late in the first half, Gary missed a block on a defensive lineman.
And he went past me with such ease and tackled the star quarterback. He got sacked so hard.
The head coach was furious. He screamed at Gary.
My lip was quivering. I was almost in tears. And I was like, "Thank you, God. Thank you. This couldn't be a clearer sign."
Gary quit. He told Dr. McGinnis.
He seemed very proud of me, and I said, "Well, what am I if I'm not a football player, if I'm not an athlete?" And he said, "Well, you'll be a man," and he didn't mean it like you'll be a masculine, macho, tough guy. He meant you'll be an adult.
Gary was able to get financial aid and stay at Boston College. He continued treating his depression. In 1993, he graduated and took a job as an accountant. At night, he started performing at open mics. Within a few years, Gary was able to quit his day job and become a full-time stand-up comedian. When Gary and I spoke, he initially said he regretted those 2 years playing football. But then he told me that if it hadn't been for the sport, he might not have gotten help for his depression for years, if ever.
I may have muddled through with a low-level depression for the rest of my life, and I may not have had the confidence to pursue comedy.
But even after starring in Netflix specials and becoming a regular on late-night TV, Gary still had to manage his mental health. Just 3 years ago, his depression and anxiety became so severe that he was hospitalized. Gary started to doubt his career choice. He thought he might never be able to do stand-up again. But he got back on stage and started doing what he'd never done before, opening up about living with depression.
If I see four prints in your ice cream, I don't need to see your kitchen. I know the dishes are piled so high you can't refill the Brita. Luckily, there was feedback. Positive feedback that I got in the form of laughter. I don't need to go into your bathroom. I know that the new roll of toilet paper is resting on the empty spool. It's the only household chore I can do while sitting on the toilet. And I'm like, not today. Not today. I don't have the strength.
Since he started talking about mental health on stage and in interviews, Gary Goldman's been hearing from a lot of strangers. Some say they're grateful he's been able to articulate what it's like to have depression. Others tell him they listen to his jokes before bed because it makes them less anxious.
So that made me feel like I needed to continue to do stand-up comedy. The more I heard from people saying that I had relieved their anxiety and depression, the more I realized that I had made the right choice.
That story came to us from Only a Game's Martin Kessler. It first aired in March of last year. Meanwhile, Gary Gulman's new HBO special called The Great Depression, it premieres on HBO this weekend. We first heard about Gary's football career on the podcast The Hilarious World of Depression. You know we'll have a link at onlyagame.org. So Tori Petri, she was at a conference for football coaches as a journalist when she was asked an unexpected question.
I am 5'6", and I do not have a bulky build by any means. Somebody approached me and was like, hey, have you ever thought of playing football? And I was like, well, not until this very moment that you mentioned it.
That's coming up on Only a Game from NPR.
I can't believe that summer is basically over.
I know. And you know what that means. The 2020 presidential race is only going to heat up.
It's a good thing we spent all summer sitting down with the Democratic candidates for president.
Hello.
It is great to be with you.
Oh, thanks for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
My pleasure.
Appreciate it.
Check out the NPR Politics podcast feed for exclusive interviews with all the candidates on the debate stage.
Subscribe.
Okay.
I'm Jason Gay, and it's time for three stories you should know.
They're saying you're destroying the purity of amateurism. Not once did they talk about the needs of these kids.
Well, they even listened to
That's you. The governor of California, Gavin Newsom, casually signing a bill into law on LeBron James' TV show, The Shop. And that's where we're going to start this week. I'm joined by Professor Kenneth Shropshire, CEO of the Global Sport Institute at Arizona State University. Hello, Ken.
Hey, Jason, how are you?
Great, thank you. And also joined in studio by Only a Game's own Karen Given. Hey, Karen.
Hey, Jason.
All right, Ken, you start us off. You're first.
Well, the governor leads us off this California Bill 206, which gives college athletes the right to market their name, image, and likeness, and to use agents in the process. And this is what many people are viewing as something that it's not. What it's not is pay for play.
Yeah.
This is not a moment where athletes are now able to be paid in California schools. What this law will allow is for some athletes that kind of have the gravitas to sign endorsement deals and lesser level athletes to give lessons and get paid. This bill doesn't go into effect until 2023. Other states are looking at similar laws.
Yeah.
But what it was, I mean, the opening really says it. The idea of a governor using an athlete's show to sign this bill is really, in some sense, a lot of what we're beginning to see much more of with Derek Jeter's Players Tribune, where players, as he says, They utilize that space as a place to share what they feel.
Yeah.
You know, we've got a real new day that we've got to start to think about and get our arms around.
With the shop appearance, it was enormously effective. You know, usually these things are happening in state houses and there are a couple of local TV cameras there and everyone politely claps, but this thing just blew up instantly, and that's a credit, obviously, to, you know, what they've built with that show, but LeBron's name, of course, and, you know, Newsom being canny enough to see what kind of platform this could be.
Yeah, absolutely. Ken, you were saying how this is kind of a new era of athletes speaking out and having this platform. And I do wonder if that's why this move was able to happen now in some ways. Like, we're hearing from athletes a lot more than we used to about the inequities. And it is amazing to me that in our deeply, deeply divided country right now, like, this is the one thing that is bringing politics together. I mean, every single California state lawmaker who cast a vote on this voted for the bill, every single one. And then the governor, despite like this huge effort by the NCAA and schools and conferences to try to get him to not sign it, signs it in the most theatrical way possible.
The most striking thing about this, it is that the myth of amateurism is dead. The Lone Ranger is the, and I hate to refer to it monolithically, is the NCAA and everybody that's kind of singing from their hymnal. And to see all these legislators in California buy into it and all these, I guess, the 7-8 other states now looking at this, I mean, that's really telling from where we were just a few years ago, where people were still defending the idea of not providing compensation to these athletes just because they had visions of ancient Greece and running around with fig leaves and playing sport for the, you know, all that stuff.
Well, and you look at, and you referred to the fact that there's momentum in other states, and you look at the other states where there's momentum. It's Ohio, it's Texas, it's Florida. I mean, do they have college sports in those places? All right, Karen, what do you got for us?
So on Thursday, Sports Illustrated laid off 40% of its staff. Let's just say that again. Sports Illustrated laid off 40% of its staff. And this thing really reeks of the worst moments of the dot-com crash. Like, remember that? So staffers were invited to an important meeting. They compared notes. They realized they hadn't all been invited to the same meeting. And as they suspected, everyone invited to the first meeting was laid off. Everyone invited to the second meeting got to keep their jobs. Yay. Meanwhile, SI intends to keep pushing out content with the help of hundreds of contract employees. And in some ways, this feels like exactly what's going on all over, you know, in all sorts of industries. On the other hand, like, this is Sports Illustrated and people are freaking out. But the response that I personally most identify with is from Brian Curtis of The Ringer, who suggests that we shouldn't see this as, quote, the day SI died. Instead, he says we should see it as the latest in a long series of awful events. And that seems just about right to me.
Ken, your thoughts?
Yeah, this is Wall Street and what is it, Blue Star Airlines. This is really somebody comes in. There's this beautiful enterprise with this name, and somehow they don't understand what it is. And somehow they really didn't have a great plan to keep it afloat. Those of us who were, you know, longing to be faces in the crowd and all those great things that SI had over the years that we all remember are sad. This is what's going on in the world. And like I was saying earlier, there are a lot of other ways that people are beginning to get their sports content. And whoever leads Sports Illustrated going forward, because there's likely to be another transaction that takes place, really needs to step back and figure out what can you do with this great brand. And clearly, this group has not figured it out.
I just hope, and the fear I have, is that this is going to somehow turn into a branding exercise for the new owners, that Sports Illustrated is simply going to be this name that's going to get slapped on a lot of products. We'll have Sports Illustrated, you know, cafes and car washes and discount hotels and so on. And I just think the DNA of a title like that is brilliantly written journalism. And there are a great many people who became professionals in this industry who were inspired by reading the work of people who worked there for many, many years. And so I just think that you cannot throw away that DNA. And if they do, those car washes are doomed. I don't mean to make any light of the scenario, no. though, because, you know, I have been personally one of those people with a cardboard box walking out of an office once, and it is not a happy thing. And my heart goes out to everybody who's going through that experience anywhere, but especially at Sports Illustrated this week. I want to segue to some happier news, which comes to us from the NBA, which is using its G League minor league outfit to Frankenstein together a new experiment. It's called 2-for-1 free throws. Now, here's the idea. A player gets a shooting foul in the G League, but instead of shooting two free throws and grinding the game to a halt as he dribbles and dribbles and dribbles some more twice, he just shoots one shot. And if that shot goes in, it counts for 2 points. It's brilliant. Here's the best part. They're also doing 3-for-1s. That's right. If you are fouled in the act of shooting a three-pointer, it's going to be one free throw for 3 whole points. But my real question to both of you is, can the New York Knicks take one free throw that will instead count for playing 82 games?
Now that is a shortcut worth doing.
But what about you, Ken? I mean, I like when sports experiment. I don't feel like they should be sacred about their rules, and I applaud these kinds of moves.
The G League needs to go over with a group of millennials and speak with Major League Baseball.
Mm-hmm.
If there's going to be some creativity in terms of speed. I mean, I never had a problem with how fast basketball is moving. I need to breathe sometimes when those guys are at the foul line. Give me a break. It's moving too fast. Slow this thing down.
So the league says they're going to take 6 to 8 minutes off the time of the game.
Yeah.
Are we really to the point where a game that's 2 hours and 6 minutes is entirely too long, but a game that is 1 hour and 58 minutes is A-OK? Like, is that really the world we live in right now?
You're talking to the wrong guy here, because I'm the person who now, when I Google a movie that I want to see, I find out how long it is first before anything else. Like, I don't even care who the actors are. I'm like, 90 minutes? I'm in. I'll do that. But anything over 2 hours.
So my thought is, if really your goal is to just have a shorter game, why don't you just take a couple minutes off of every quarter? Like, why get rid of free throws, which I enjoy? Like, to me, that's a tension moment. It's like when you've got the action film and it's all very actiony, and then they have to like sneak somewhere and you're like holding your breath. Like, that's I enjoy that moment.
Free throwing is the putting of basketball. I mean, you know, it's the dramatic. Is he going to? He should. Well, this is so easy. He should make it.
Right.
I just wonder if there are going to be coaches in the G League who are going to try to hack this strategy by just, you know, launching three-pointers from all parts of the court to try to get these 3-for-1 foul shots. My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been Professor Kenneth Shropshire, CEO of the Global Sport Institute at Arizona State. Thank you, Ken.
Thank you.
And Only a Game's very own Karen Given. Thank you, Karen.
Thanks, Jason.
You know that moment when life is just chugging along just fine and then boom, it all changes? That's a curveball. Here's Only a Game's Karen Given.
In the spring of 2015, Tori Petri found herself lying flat on her back on a turf field in Detroit, Michigan, as she looked up through the face mask of her football helmet and struggled to catch her breath. Another woman stood over her and laughed. In that moment, Tori thought to herself,
"Am I crazy? Should I really have done this? Is this over the top?"
To answer those questions, we have to go back to July of 2013. This time, Tori was poolside in Hollywood, Florida.
It's press photo day at the Miss Florida USA pageant, and boy, is it hot.
It was summertime in South Florida, so yeah, it was hot. But the 71 Miss Florida USA contestants didn't seem to mind the heat. One of those contestants was Tori Petri.
But it's really fun. Everybody's got a lot of energy. We've all worked.
Tori did both of these things, taking a hard hit on the football field and wearing a swimsuit and a crown, because she wanted to prepare herself for the job she has today, working in the NFL for the Detroit Lions. Let's go all the way back to the beginning. Tori Petri grew up south of Gainesville, Florida, Gators territory. She loved football, but she probably would have only loved it from the stands, if not for a clerical error.
I was accidentally placed in a TV productions class in high school.
The beauty pageants came later.
I didn't do my first pageant until my senior year of high school. I had actually applied for a scholarship that required me to read an essay on stage at a community event. One of the organizers, her daughter was a pageant girl, and she kind of pulled me aside afterwards and was like, "Have you ever thought about doing pageants?"
Tori hadn't, but she thought about it, and she decided it was a good idea.
I knew by that point in my life that I wanted to go into broadcasting, and there was so much public speaking, there was so much interview training, that's why I did it.
After high school, Tori went to the University of Florida.
And I got involved in covering sports there pretty quickly.
Welcome back. I'm Tori Petri. The Gator football team clinched a huge win over top...
My senior year, I finally worked my way up to being on the football beat, which was the most coveted one, obviously, because it's SEC football. I was on the sidelines for every game that season.
And all that time, did you find yourself ever saying, "Gee, I wish I was out there"?
No, I actually had not thought about it at the time.
Tori says she applied to dozens of jobs after school, but one really caught her eye: multimedia reporter for the Detroit Lions. The Lions called to offer her the job on a Monday.
And by Friday, I had moved to Michigan for good.
You are watching Lions Post Game Live. I'm Tori Petri alongside...
One day, Tori might be sitting in his studio dissecting the team's latest game. The next, she might be filming a segment singing carpool karaoke with Lions punter Sam Martin.
Now you're looking pretty in the hotel.
Tori had packed up and left Florida so quickly, it took a while for her furniture to arrive in Detroit. But she had bigger things to worry about. She had been raised on SEC football. She had a lot to learn about the Detroit Lions and their history.
And so I would sit in my empty apartment on my blow-up mattress and just scour the internet, just really study up as much as I could. And it was like that before I left for work in the mornings. It was like that after I got home from work in the evenings. It was just really digging in and being like, "Hey, I know you doubt me right now. I know that you aren't convinced why this girl from Florida should have come up here and be covering the sports team that you've followed your entire life."
Tori decided it wasn't enough to learn everything she could about the Detroit Lions. She wanted to learn everything she could about the game of football itself. So in the off-season after her first year, she attended a conference for high school and college coaches.
I mean, I looked so out of place. I am, you know, I am 5'6", and I do not have a bulky build by any means. Somebody approached me and was like, "Hey, are you a football coach?" And I was like, "Oh, no, I'm a journalist. I'm, you know, just here to learn." And so they're like, "You know, have you ever thought of playing football?" And I was like, "Well, not until this very moment that you mentioned it."
The man's name was Keith Thomas. At the time, he was coaching defensive backs for the Detroit Dark Angels.
I took down his name and the name of the football team, and I was like, "Is this a real thing? Is this something that people do?" And I ended up looking it up online and was like, "Wow, these girls are legit. This is a semi-pro football team, and this could be an opportunity for me to learn the game of football like I never have before." So I called him up, and he's like, "Okay, come out to practice. Bring your pads and your helmet." I'm like, "Well, I don't have pads and a helmet."
Well, so take me to your tryout. Like, did you prepare for it? You seem like a person who prepares for everything.
Yeah, I definitely do try to prepare for everything. But in this particular situation, I don't know that there was much that I could prepare for because I just really did not know what was going to happen.
Tryouts had already come and gone, so Tori was just thrown into practices. And her teammates, some of whom had been playing the game for years, didn't take it easy on her.
I remember one time in particular that I just got thrown on the ground so hard. I had to lay there and catch my breath for a second, and the girl stood over me, and this is my teammate. She was just trying to help me learn. She stood over me in that moment. She said, "Now you'll learn to always keep your head on a swivel." I was like, "Okay, you're right, I will," because that really hurt.
This was the hit that made Tori wonder if she was crazy to be playing football. But she stuck with it, mostly playing defensive back so she could give the hard hits instead of taking them. At first, Tori didn't tell the other women on the team about her day job, and she didn't tell her coworkers at her day job about what she was doing in her off hours, which proved to be complicated.
I would show up to work just absolutely covered in bruises, and so I would like wear long sleeves, and you know, the season is from April to June, so it wasn't exactly long sleeve season.
So what happened when you finally did tell your coworkers? Was it the kind of thing where someone spotted one of those bruises and you had to explain, or?
Yeah, well, eventually I did end up having a conversation. And I was like, hey, just so you know, this is kind of what's happening. This is why I have bruises. And I think that there was like, oh my gosh, are you going to do something to hurt yourself?
Tori Petrie played two seasons with the Dark Angels. She eventually became a starter, and her highlight reel on YouTube shows that she had some skills. She had to stop playing when she could no longer juggle her work and football schedules. Tori had a hard time leaving her teammates, who'd become friends.
But I felt like I had really learned and grown in the ways that I needed to. I understand this game better. I can see it unfold better because I've seen it from field level and watched it unfold from field level.
I'm having a little bit of an internal struggle because on the one hand, this is such a cool experience and I get that you learned so much. On the other hand, I don't want women to feel like you can't cover football unless you go play.
No, definitely not. No, that's not the case at all. For me, this is just what learning looked like, and I got a lot out of it. But if you can talk to people, if you can tell their stories, if you can help fans understand the game better, that's what covering sports is.
Tori Petrie says she was never the best or even the most glamorous player on the Dark Angels, but as a reporter for the Detroit Lions, she does have the biggest platform, and she wants to use it to bring attention to all the women who are playing the game today.
That's Only a Game's Karen Given. That story first aired in February this year. Tori Petrie, meanwhile, she's in her sixth season with the Detroit Lions. Keith Giroux did not have any fancy equipment the time he ran his first marathon. All he had was a pair of green prison-issue pants, a portable radio, and a treadmill.
Somebody brought me a water bottle, which was something huge because we weren't allowed to have those. We didn't have them ourselves, so they had to get approved through security and everything, and someone had to bring it to me.
Coming up, running a marathon in prison. And remember, follow us on Facebook and Twitter at OnlyAGameNPR.
There are places in the United States where voting districts are made up mostly of prisoners who can't vote.
Forgive me for not having been able to articulate this the way I want to, but it's almost like your body being used.
On NPR's Code Switch, the connection between the U.S. Census, politics, and prisons.
I'm Jason Gay. Next week on Only a Game, cerebral palsy may have prevented play-by-play guy Jason Benetti from playing tuba in a marching band, but it did not prevent him from securing his dream job with the Chicago White Sox. But now, Charlie Pierce is here with the week's news. Hi, Charlie.
Hey, Jason.
Charlie, on Monday, Oakland Raiders linebacker Vontaze Burfict was suspended without pay for the rest of the season after his hit on Colts tight end Jack Doyle. Now, Burfict is a known offender here, but the whole season, is this an extreme reaction or just more of the NFL's on-again, off-again approach to discipline?
Well, I think it's the NFL's being fed up with Vontaze Burfict's act more than anything else. I mean, he's hardly a first-time offender here, and this hit with, I mean, he came running at Doyle from the next county. I have no sympathy for him at all. I think losing a year is probably getting off pretty lightly given his track record.
Do you think we'll see him back in the NFL?
Yes, I do. I think if he takes a year and doesn't make too much trouble, he will find redemption with some team.
Meanwhile, Jets quarterback Sam Darnold says he's ready to play after his recovery from mononucleosis, but that he's not willing to risk his life by coming back too soon. It has to do with his spleen. I imagine he has an enlarged spleen, which he can't take a serious contact to. But don't Jets quarterbacks typically risk their lives anyway?
Well, I mean, that's in a metaphorical sense. Yes, they do. This is serious and good for Sam Darnold for thinking in advance. I'm sure his doctors have leaned on him, too. I want to make sure that I'm safe out there, said Sam, and I'm not going to die. So we're going to have to wait for Sam's spleen to get back down to normal before he takes the field.
Charlie, Minshew mania continues apace in Jacksonville, where the Jaguars are seeking to cash in on their overnight star quarterback with a Minshew mini pack of tickets that includes tickets to Jags games, not only against the Saints and Jets, but also a bandana and a mustache. I respect the enthusiasm, Charlie, but is this putting a little too much pressure on a young quarterback to keep his facial hair? What's going on?
Well, he's got me. This goes back to Washington State last year, and the only reason I know this is I have some friends who are Washington State fans who keep me updated on all things Washington State on the electric Twitter machine. This whole mustache thing, everybody, you know, you show up in Pullman for game day wearing fake mustaches. So this isn't anything new.
Right.
The reason for all of this is that Gardner Minshew has played very well, as can probably be indicated by the fact that they're giving away tickets. Jacksonville needs a little boost at the box office. So
I'm trying to think of a comparable quarterback mania in recent history. I guess Tebow had a minute there with the Broncos, maybe Flutie Flakes in Buffalo when Doug Flutie had that run with the Bills.
Yeah, I'm not exactly seeing the intense charisma of either of the Manning brothers involved in this. And Tom Brady's got stuff associated with him, but it's all expensive, you know, pajamas and water.
This is Charlie, the NHL season is underway, and it's now been 5 long months since St. Louis Blues last won a Stanley Cup. Have the Blues, who had never before won a cup before last season, do they have the stuff to go back-to-back?
I don't think so, because I think one of the remarkable things about last year's NHL playoffs was that teams that played clearly the best over the regular season all went out early.
Yeah.
The Tampa Bay Lightning got swept by Columbus. I don't think that's going to happen again. So I think one of the teams that ran away with the league last year is going to win the cup. I don't know which one yet, but I don't think it's going to be the Blues.
Reliable sources inform me that Cardi B will soon have a new album, but what is this? How is this a sports story exactly?
She's going to name the album Tiger Woods. Apparently, she remembers when everybody was, you know, talking trash about Tiger Woods, and then he won, you know, he came back and won the Masters, and now she's going to name the album that.
Do you think it came down to, like, Tiger Woods or Jim Furyk was the...
I don't know. See, I was wondering about that. But actually, you know, if you eliminate, you know, the golfer, Tiger Woods is a pretty good album name.
It is kind of a
great
name.
I mean, it's a pretty good album name.
Right. It does a lot. You can think of a lot of different images, for sure.
And, of course, the follow-up album, Eldrick, will be an even bigger hit.
Finally, Charlie, an amazing story this week about a 9-year-old runner in Minnesota who entered a 5K race, took a wrong turn, and wound up with a rather impressive result.
Cade Lovell of St. Cloud, Minnesota, was in this 5K race, took a wrong turn, and wound up winning a 10K race. I don't know how that's possible.
What does it say about the quality of talent that was in the 10K? Or maybe this kid is a phenom.
Maybe. We got to keep an eye on Cade Lovell. Who knows? He may accidentally win the Olympic marathon.
We should.
Year.
We put her in our fantasy runner pool. Charlie Pierce is guest editor of the Best American Sports Writing of 2019 on bookshelves now. And he joins us each week here at Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Jason.
We've dedicated today's show to stories about the curveball, the metaphorical curveball, that is, you know, those moments in life where things take an unexpected path. For Keith Giroux, that path ran alongside an electrified fence inside the West Tennessee State Penitentiary. Here's WBUR's Shira Springer with a story that first aired in 2017.
Left up here.
Where?
It's just before that tan building there.
We're driving through the foothills of the Berkshires in western Massachusetts, passing rundown houses and the abandoned Strathmore paper mill. We're headed to Turner's Falls for a run. This is the place where Keith Giroux grew up and got into trouble. Now it's where he's trying to stay out of trouble.
The contrast between how I live today and how I lived 10 years ago is just so drastic. I started, you know, drinking and smoking cigarettes, you know, before I was 11. Became quite the alcoholic and got into heavier drugs.
By 17, Giroux was a dad. By 18, he was on his own. Sometimes he went to work high or with a hangover. Sometimes he didn't bother showing up at all. He lost his factory job. He couldn't pay for the rent for his room in a boarding house. And he started breaking into bars and liquor stores for cash and alcohol.
I didn't start getting incarcerated until I was 18. And since then, I've accumulated 8 years of incarceration. Every bit of trouble I've ever got into was due to alcohol. Everything I've ever been incarcerated for was addiction related.
His crimes range from breaking and entering to larceny to assault and battery. Back in August 2015, Giroux was 29 years old and locked up at the West Tennessee State Penitentiary. That's when he started to change his life.
Running actually was born out of boredom. I was sitting in prison. I needed something different. There's a lot of card playing and TV watching, and everybody works out. But we didn't have much access to the gym, and I push-ups, pull-ups, dips, and all that just was not my thing. So I needed something new, and I decided to try running. I'd never been a runner before that. I smoked cigarettes all my life and used to hate having to run in gym class. But getting out in that prison yard, every time we'd get out there, I'd try to run a little further and maybe a little faster, and it felt pretty good.
Giroux followed a grass path along the prison yard's perimeter, running beside an electrified razor wire fence. One lap around was about half a mile.
What did you think about when you were running around the prison yard?
Probably everything I wanted to do when I got out. Just all the dreams I've had, you know, through all the years I've spent incarcerated, all I wanted to do with my life that I hadn't been able to yet. You know. Really just building a life.
Sometimes his thoughts drifted toward family. He hadn't been a part of his son's life for years, but he dreamed of building a relationship. 6 weeks after he began running, Giroux was transferred to the Franklin County Jail in Greenfield, Massachusetts. But in Greenfield, there was no yard, just a treadmill.
I started jumping on that every day, and before you know it, kind of became an obsession.
He set small goals, always trying to run farther and faster. He talked to the jail staff about training and racing, and soon he set one big goal. He would run a marathon in prison. Since he'd heard about the history and prestige of the Boston Marathon, he would make his attempt on the same day as the big race. The monotony of running 26.2 miles on a treadmill is mind-boggling, but for Giroux, that was just the start.
The shoes I had been running in were absolutely horrible. Plain white Velcro strap orthopedic shoes that were probably a bit small for me, too. I knew I couldn't run that far in those, so I was running around frantically looking for shoes, but we're very limited in there because you can only have shoes that are approved through their medical department and don't have shoelaces, and they're not built for running, you know. So at the last second before we locked in for the night, a fellow inmate lent me his shoes, you know, which were just some old classic Reeboks. They were crap. They were crap. They were beat up, no support, and nothing. Not made for running either.
Another issue, prisoners have to be in their cells at certain times, so he needed a 4-hour window without any scheduled headcounts. That meant he'd have to start his marathon when everyone else was at breakfast. And the prison treadmill was set to shut off after 1 hour. So Giroux planned to break his marathon into 6 segments. He would run a segment, then record his distance and time, then restart the treadmill, then do it all over again. At 7:30 a.m. on Monday, April 18th, 2016.
I'm in green cotton polyester jail-issued pants and a plain white cotton t-shirt and my crappy shoes. I have a portable Walkman radio. It's just a cheap little FM AM radio. I have a towel to wipe the sweat off and all that good stuff. I have a small cup of salt, handful of Jolly Ranchers, and a piece of paper and a pen to mark my times down on. A few minutes into that second segment, somebody brought me a water bottle, which was something huge because we weren't allowed to have those. We didn't have them ourselves, so they had to get approved through security and everything, and someone had to bring it to me. And then, so that was cool. And then we had called up to the kitchen and had some ice sent down, so I was able to, you know, have some ice water and a nice little fancy water bottle as I ran.
Giroux felt good as he passed the halfway mark, even though it was the farthest he'd ever run. But
by the time I got to about 22 miles, I was tuckered out.
He slowed to a fast walk for a couple minutes, then refocused and sped up. He wanted to run across the finish line.
As the last mile approached, everybody started gathering around, and I had quite the little crowd, inmates and staff. And that last half mile, I felt a little burst of energy coming out. It's like last quarter mile, I cranked it up to 10 and sprinted to the end.
Giroux's prison version of the Boston Marathon took 4 hours and 14 minutes. He'd hoped to run faster, but his disappointment faded as he set a new goal. He wanted to run a real marathon when he got out of jail. Giroux says he's been released from jail more times than he can count. But when he got out in the fall of 2016, it was different.
Every other time I walked out of incarceration, I walked out to not having any idea of what I was going to do with my life. You know, I still had dreams then, but I had no idea of how to set one foot in front of the other to work toward any of those. But this time, you know, I come out with this big goal of running a marathon, and all I have to do is run toward it.
Giroux ran his first real marathon 3 weeks after he was released, and he's still running. He gets training advice from running groups on Facebook. What shoes to buy, what workouts to try, what to eat.
Everybody who runs is always like posting their workouts, and I post a lot of my workouts to people are just always very, very, very supportive, especially if you're like going hard on yourself, like man, I had a crap workout, and they'd be like, no, you had a great workout, you know, and they always tell you how proud they are of like all your accomplishing and everything, and it's a lot of motivation to keep doing good things. I've never accomplished anything before. So I've been out of jail now for about 4 months. Just the fact that I haven't found something to get myself back in is an accomplishment in itself. I've also been clean for the 4 months that I've been out, which is another huge accomplishment. Every day is a struggle, but it's what allows me to live a life.
Through his running connections, Giroux secured a charity entry into the 2017 Boston Marathon. He was working 12-hour shifts at a factory job and training mostly on dark, cold winter nights. 1 year after he ran Boston on a prison treadmill, Keith Giroux was cheered along the famous course by family and friends. But one very important person was missing from the crowd. His 13-year-old son.
Yeah, I've spent so much time away that he probably doesn't even remember me at all. And sometimes I worry about the things he might have heard about me, you know, growing up. And so I imagine what kind of picture he might hold in his head of what kind of man his dad is. And whatever it is, I want to change all that. I want him to see, you know, nothing but a good man.
That story came from WBUR's Shira Springer. Now, not long after it aired in March of 2017, Keith Giroux reconnected with his son. He says they now spend as much time together as they can. Last fall, though, Keith started drinking again. He pled guilty to an OUI and spent 5 months in the Franklin County Jail. He was released in April. He says he's sober now and training for November's New York City Marathon, and that will be his third world major and his seventh marathon overall, including that one he ran while in prison. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach with help from Jonathan Chang. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our executive producer is Karen Gibbon. I'm Jason Gay. Only a Game returns next week. Thanks for listening.